Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. Good to be back. Good to talk to you, Bill Scher.
It's been a bit of a wild Washington week on both sides of the aisle. I would suspect there is much gleefulness on the Republican side, seeing Democrats in a bit of a civil war, but at the same time, there's some uncertainty in the Republican presidential field if their standard bearer can handle basic questioning.
Yes, well, let's start with the left because we so rarely do. I mean, it's been, I don't know, the last 7 or 8 years, all the action's been on the right. The Democrats have been very disciplined. At least, you know, their fighting seemed to mostly take place behind closed doors. They've been singing off the same choir sheet, and Republicans have been airing their dirty laundry, have been having public internecine spats, and now this Trans-Pacific, whatever, fast-track trade promotion authority, whatever, you know, whatever it is exactly, you know, Obama wants it, and the Senate Democrats blocked it. You've got Elizabeth Warren opposing it, Obama publicly chastising her, calling her Elizabeth. And what's the latest I heard? Somebody accused Obama of being sexist?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit of a side show. I don't think it's going to blow up. But I mean, what's really underlying, I mean, let me just preface that, you know, full disclosure, where I work, Campaign for America's Future, campaign is very actively opposing Fast Track and opposing TPP. Nevertheless, I will do my best to be a detached analysis of the fissures on the left best I can. I mean, I think what's happening here is, there basically is a different perspective coming from Obama and from the traditional left. From the traditional left, that's sort of being epitomized by Warren, led by Warren right now. We've had decades of bad trade deals that have, if not caused, accelerated or worsened negative aspects of globalization. They have pushed wages lower across the world, which has hurt workers here and abroad. They've weakened labor standards, weakened environmental standards, and that's hollowed out. That's contributed to the hollowing out of the American middle class, and this needs to be reversed. From Obama's perspective, you know, that's in the past. You know, that if you defeat TPP, you don't fix those problems.
Right.
In his words, the horse has left the barn.
And by the way, just to drill down on it, so this would basically allow the president to negotiate a trade deal, and then the Senate or whatever would give it an up or down vote. They would not add amendments and poison pills and slow down the process. Is that basically what it would do?
Right, and sort of what's a bit strange about because what we're talking about is the fast track vote. Does the president have fast track negotiation authority to negotiate a trade agreement that Congress cannot amend? They can still vote it down. They can't amend it on the floor. On one hand, you know, Obama's saying, I need fast track to finalize the negotiations. I can't get a final deal if the 12 other Pacific nations don't believe that what they're negotiating is what's going to get voted on. But the lion's share of the agreement has been negotiated, as far as we can tell. I mean, there obviously are discussion drafts that are floating around. There's things that Congress can look at behind closed doors, but not all the T's have been crossed yet. So there's sort of two, you know, dividing lines here. If I can just circle back to what I was saying before. So on one hand, Obama is saying, look, the basic trade agreement's a good thing. This is a step towards better worker protections and better environmental protections. Maybe it doesn't solve every problem under the sun. It's not going to make everything completely level. You know, it's not like Chinese workers are going to make the same exact wage as American workers on day one, but this is a step in the right direction. and I can't turn back the clock and fix what happened in the past. And whereas on the left, you're saying this is the time to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, no mas, and try to spark something that's more transformational. So I think there's that divide.
Right.
So well, and then on the fast track, you have the Warren folks saying this is tantamount to a vote for the trade deal. So we have in theory, we could still vote no on TPP when the full agreement is unveiled, and everybody can look at the specifics. There'll be a waiting period for people to look at the provisions and then vote on that. But they are trying to argue that as a practical matter, that wouldn't be what there'd be such a push for passage. There'll be such a scare tactics used. If you vote the whole thing down, everything is lost. This way, we can argue for a better deal because we'll have the opportunity to amend it and improve it. Whereas Obama would say, well, you can't amend it in Congress. I can't take that to the 12 nations because obviously whatever you're going to tack onto us, things that they're not going to like. And so we're going to be at loggerheads. So those are the fault lines that are underlying this discussion. And because Warren is such a popular figure, Obama essentially is trying to take her down a peg so it would be easier for a Democrat to vote against her. And I think that's why the debate has gotten as personal as it has. I mean, I think Obama has probably made it more personal than the left have been making it up until this point. And so when over the weekend, Obama told Matt Bai at Yahoo News that Elizabeth is just wrong about this, which he had said in a few other venues, but sort of an added dig that she's a politician like everybody else, that was seen by Warren's allies as being particularly insulting. And so Senator Sherrod Brown yesterday said that was a sexist thing for Obama to have said, to refer to her by her first name and demeanor like that, which prompted some pushback from the White House saying, here are all the times that the president used Sherrod Brown's first name in discussing his stuff. So I think that aspect of it, I think, is probably not what's most important here. But what is most important is that you have heightened emotions, probably more so than you have any other issue that has, I mean, there's been friction between Obama and the left before, but this has been the most pronounced.
So I guess I have a couple observations and then a question for you. One, Dana Milbank had a good piece at the Post talking about how Democrats are rankled over Obama's sort of dismissive attitude over this and treatment of them. And that's essentially the way he's been treating Republicans for a long time. I mean, I just want Democrats and liberals to understand at least part of the reason that he is disliked is because this is his style. This is his sort of dismissive, arrogant way that he treats his political adversaries. What Elizabeth Warren is now getting is basically what Republicans have been dealing with for the past, you know, 6 or 7 years. That's number one. Number two, it is, of course, refreshing for Republicans to see this fight. A couple weeks ago, we talked about whether or not this schism would arise on the right, and it has a little bit. Since we talked about it, Mike Huckabee came out in full force against this. At least against this for Obama, against giving Obama more power to do anything unilaterally. But here's my sort of statement/question for you, Bill. So I'm sort of consistent having a kind of a libertarian position on this, right? So I'm very pro-immigration and I'm very pro-free trade. And to me, those things are very consistent. And even someone like Mike Huckabee, who's on the other side, he's a populist, I'm not, but at least he's making a sort of consistent argument, right? He's saying to protect American workers, we need less, you know, illegal immigration at least. And there are people like Scott Walker even saying less immigration or implying that, to be more specific. So sort of opposing on economic grounds, opposing these sort of globalization free trade policies is consistent with being also against increased immigration. Yet the left seems to be at odds on that. That on one hand, they want to protect American workers from cheaper products coming from, say, China. And by the way, let me just say, that means that we as consumers get to pay less money for products. I mean, that helps me that I can go to Walmart or Target and buy a product for less because we got, you know, because we have free trade and imports. So I think you see where I'm going with this. So like, shouldn't, by the same logic, shouldn't Democrats be against, shouldn't they want to deport all the illegals and essentially shut down immigration by the same logic?
Well, I think there was a time when there were some Democrats who did put forth arguments like that.
It's but isn't it consistent with their trade policy?
Healing between, what's that?
That's what I'm saying, though. But isn't that very consistent with their arguments they're making about trade and about protecting the American worker?
Well, I mean, there's a parallel. I mean, it's both looking at those issues in a zero sum frame. That you know, with immigration, if an immigrant worker comes here, it takes a job away from me. In trade, if a manufacturing job goes to China, it's a job lost here. The question in both cases is there a non-zero sum way to look at it? If just because some of these jobs shift around, or in the case of trade, these jobs have already shifted, they're already not coming back here. Is there a way that we can have rules of the road internationally that allow for a healthy flow of goods that is two-way, that helps people both more exporting from us and more cheaper imports from here, that elevate worker standards abroad? So you know, it's a very multifaceted situation where you know, obviously, some on the left do look at it in a zero-sum way, that this is going to be a net loss for us, and therefore it is bad. And Obama's trying to make, Obama, in both the immigration case and the trade case, he's trying to say, look, this is going to be win-win. This is going to be healthy for workers in general when it comes to immigration. It's going to increase demand. It's going to grow our tax base. In the case of trade, he's making both the export argument. This is going to actually help what manufacturers we do have here. It's going to help us sell our goods abroad. And he's making the import cost argument. This is going to make sure that we're going to be able to access cheap goods and things that we do want from abroad. So he's trying to make a multi-layered argument. You know, folks on the left are not really buying it. But to your other point, you know, these folks should be sympathetic to how mean old Obama has treated Republicans all these years. You know, we still don't know. He might still win the argument here. I mean, he had the setback, obviously, with the filibuster deal. That's because you had about 10 or so self-described pro-trade Democrats who say, we want to pass TPP, we just want to do it with other provisions alongside of it. They are not echoing Warren's rhetoric. They're making their own case. And you even have Harry Reid, who was saying, I've never voted for a trade agreement in my life, and I'm not going to start now, putting out an olive branch to Republicans saying, hey, maybe we can take this currency bill. This is one of the sticking points. Should there be a provision in the agreement or alongside the agreement that cracks down on currency manipulation by Asian countries? You have Reid say, okay, well, we're willing to separate that out now. Does that help them broker a deal? So yeah.
Well,
that Obama's strategy is going to pay off in the end for him. We don't know yet.
Let me ask you this, Bill. I mean, obviously, this is part of this is a product of a lame duck presidency, of the willingness to publicly disagree with him. But is some of the but does this imply? Because you know, Bill, I'm writing this book about the right and focused a lot about the kind of internecine problems and the struggle for the heart and soul and sort of. What is the Republican Party? What is the conservative movement going to be about going forward? And really, that's where the action has been. Is this a harbinger of things to come? I mean, does this imply that if, let's say that Republicans win in 2016, could Democrats go through a decade of fights and squabbles that have been essentially suppressed up until now? They've been dormant during the Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi era.
Well, I mean, I still think you see a lot of Democrats assuming they will win in 2016. I don't think no one's quite gotten in the headspace of we're likely to lose. The folks still feel like Democrats have the upper hand. And you're seeing, I think, by and large, mostly convergence on issues on the left. There's obviously tensions. Trade is one of them. How you deal with banks is another. How far do you go? There is the expand Social Security movement that probably Hillary would not embrace. But there's a whole lot of overlap between even what establishment Democrats want and what populist Democrats want. You're seeing a lot of overlap on paid family leave and paid sick leave. Hillary pushed that in a Mother's Day video over the weekend. You're seeing overlap on making college essentially free or debt free. That's really pushing the envelope for some on the right. But you're seeing even Larry Summers take that stance. But to your lame duck point, I think this is, I mean, there's an element to that, that there is the increased willingness to oppose Obama. You feel like your fate is not as intertwined with his. But I also think, number one, it's Obama's choice to have delayed this fight up until now and not want to force this issue when he was still running for re-election. And you still see Obama having a lot of juice in the Iran debate, where he pretty much, there was some Democratic squirming about that, but he kept those guys in line and even got Bob Corker to come around and put forth a bill that didn't tie Obama's hands in the Iran deal. And that's now looking like it's going to sail through both houses of Congress without any amendments. So yeah. I don't think it's right to say that Obama sort of lost all of his magic.
No, I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that. But in terms of the possibility of an internecine struggle, you and I both know that the action on the left isn't, the real action is about populism, and it's the Elizabeth Warren populism brand versus really the Bill Clinton brand. The Bill Clinton model is a better way of putting it. And so it makes sense that this, if there is to be an emerging battle, that it would be an economic one on the left.
Well, the Bill Clinton model, Bill Clinton got elected in 92 in part because he moved rightward on welfare and he moved rightward on crime issues, the death penalty. But he still had a healthy dose of economic populism in his 92 rhetoric. And he was pretty progressive when it came to gay rights. He gets sort of knocked around for Defense of Marriage Act now. But let's not forget, he pushed, gays in the military in the 92 campaign. And that was a harbinger for, the cultural shift on the left that Obama furthered, when he ran. So it's a bit of a complicated picture. And then what he didn't campaign on in 92, but he governed on, particularly in his second term, was financial deregulation and trying to keep Wall Street, within the Democratic big tent. So that deregulation is a big part of his policy agenda. That's sort of a sore spot today. Whereas now you see, great agreement on the left as far as Wall Street should be regulated. There may be disagreement on breaking up the big banks, but there's no push on the left or any part of the Democratic Party to deregulate Wall Street anew. So there's an element of how the party wings have really come together. So I see trade really as somewhat isolated here. I mean, trade has been an issue that cuts across party lines for a long time. And the NAFTA was largely passed with Republican votes. It's got more Democratic votes than Obama's going to get on this one.
Right.
But it's still been a dividing line on both sides for a while. I think that's specific to the issue.
NAFTA was Bill Clinton, right?
Right.
And China, for trade with China, preferred nation status or whatever. I think that was Clinton.
Clinton in 92, Clinton in 92 campaigned on an anti-China platform. I mean, it's very typical to campaign as a populist on trade and govern as a free trader. That's kind of the standard approach, you know.
I understand the first part of the equation. I understand why you would pander, the populist pandering, but why do they then govern as free traders? Just because it's smart policy and it actually will help improve the economy? What explains this?
The charitable view is that while the issue animates certain blue-collar voters in swing states, you campaign as a populist, and then when you get there, you say, "Look, it's better for the economy to have to have freer trade, and it stimulates economic activity." So you quietly move in that direction once you get in power. You know, in Obama's case, I think you know he did try to. He would argue that he wanted to recalibrate trade, find a middle ground on trade. He put it in his book, Audacity of Hope. He said he was going to renegotiate NAFTA, in the campaign. He's arguing that TPP is essentially a version of that renegotiation. And he's arguing that this is the most progressive trade deal in history, that he has followed through on that pledge to thread this needle. That's the Obama view.
I guess the cynical way of viewing it would be,
yeah,
you campaign and pander to the sort of populists, but you, with a wink and a nod, tell your donors you're going to govern
right, the
way they want.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's the cynical way.
That is the cynical view. Yes, okay. And there's like plenty on the left who see it that way. And this is where Obama is putting his personal credibility on the line vis-a-vis Warren. I think the left, by and large, was restrained from personally haranguing Obama, knowing he still maintains a lot of sway amongst the Democratic base. Obama escalated the fight by saying it's ridiculous to argue. I put all this energy into strengthening the middle class, passing the Recovery Act, passing Dodd-Frank, doing the bank reform, to just, you know, cavalierly unravel it over this. You know, why would I do that? That would be stupid. I'm not a stupid guy. Most Democrats think Obama is not a stupid guy. So he's putting a lot of his personal reputation on the line with this. And we'll see if that is sufficient to get enough Democratic votes to come aboard. And will this provoke the Warren crowd to more overtly make that cynical argument that Obama is essentially bought and sold by corporate money now? I don't think anyone's really saying that. I think people would find it very hard to compute considering all the other things that he has done. But that charge is sort of simmering under the surface right now.
All right. Well, fun to have some parity.
And there's still the Hillary question. You know, I mean, Hillary still has not come. She has not said anything about fast track, and she's only talked about general criteria for what would make a good trade deal. She's talked more positively about TPP in the past, in general terms. Although she has also laid down some markers of things she wanted to see in the deal that may not be in the final deal, not knowing all the specifics. You know, there's this issue about how disputes would be arbitrated. You know, what kind of What rights would a corporation have to sue a government if the provisions of the trade deal were being violated? The Warren folks are saying that this is going to be a tool for corporations to undo our laws, and citing what's happened in Australia with tobacco regulations. You know, corporations suing Australia saying your bans on packaging are a violation of international rules. And Obama is saying, look, when you see the specifics, you're going to see that, you know, that kind of situation is not going to happen. They're not going to be able to undo our laws with this because our standards are already high. It's really a problem with other countries who have low standards that this is going to be targeting. And the Warren folks will say, well, you're making it all secret, so I can't know what it is that you are saying. And Obama's saying, well, you're going to know after Fast Track passes because you're going to have 60 days before the final vote. So that's where we go around in circles and all this.
So meanwhile, Jeb Bush has had a rough couple of days. He had an interview with Megyn Kelly where she asked him, knowing what you know now, you know, would you have gone into Iraq? He essentially ignored the question and answered it basically saying, would you have gone in? And he basically said, you know, well, you know, Hillary Clinton voted for it too. So he took a little flack from that, by sort of evading the question. And it was unclear whether or not he misunderstood the question. And then Anna Navarro, who is a commentator who has gotten a lot of mileage out of sort of being friends with Jeb, as a CNN commentator, went on TV and said that she emailed Jeb and that he said that he misheard it. Then Jeb goes on, I think it was a Sean Hannity radio show, and essentially says he doesn't know, knowing what he knows now, not clear if he whether or not he would have invaded Iraq, and says mistakes were made, which is something I guess you shouldn't say about anything. This prompted, you know, Rand Paul had already been on the record, you know, saying that Iraq was a mistake. Now you've got Chris Christie and Ted Cruz on the record saying that they wouldn't have done it, at least knowing what they know now. So,
Just say this is the exact Jeb quote from the Hannity show yesterday. He said, "I interpreted the question wrong, I guess," referring to the Megyn Kelly interview. Knowing what we know now, you know, clearly there were mistakes as it related to faulty intelligence in the lead up to the war and the lack of focus on security. And my brothers admitted this, and we have to learn from this. Then Hannity pushes him again, you know, would you actually do the invasion? That's when he says, I don't know what that decision would have been. That's hypothetical.
Yeah.
So that's his attempt to clean up the Fox, the Megyn Kelly answer, but it basically is the same answer with the added point that, I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, it is interesting that Jeb was going to fairly friendly media who were not attempting to, you know, really have a gotcha question. And I think you have to give Hannity some credit here by the follow-up. He could have left Jeb off sort of off the hook there, and he asked that follow-up question, and I think that made it a story.
I feel like Hannity was kind of like, hey, buddy, I'm trying to bail you out here. I know you're not answering it, and you got to answer it.
So this is a really problematic thing, I think. I mean, I think it's fair. I think there were ways that Jeb could have sort of ducked the question, avoided criticizing his brother, but still sort of answered it. And he didn't do that effectively. But I think it is reasonable. I mean, if we're going to be electing a commander in chief, I think it's reasonable to sort of like go back to the last war and get their take on it. And I think it's imperative to demonstrate that you learned the lessons that are learnable, and maybe some things aren't learnable, but that you've learned the lessons. And I think it's also, it's not asking too much to insist that the next, you know, president of the United States has a coherent foreign policy worldview. Not to say that they'll always stick to it. You know, George W. Bush ran on a humble foreign policy, but anyway, it's a real problem, and it is interesting. You know, you got people like Ted Cruz who worked in the Bush administration now saying that he wouldn't have gone into Iraq. And I don't even, maybe he assumed the preface, the caveat about knowing what you know now. That was on Megyn Kelly. And I don't know that was actually part of the question. But anyway, this has sort of forced all the Republicans now to kind of take a stand. I mean, in the long run, that actually might be healthy. But, you know, probably talking about George W. Bush and Iraq, probably not exactly where you want to be. But Jeb Bush has now kind of made that happen.
You know, I this may be a short conversation because I agree with you completely, it strikes me as just a huge missed opportunity because you know this question is coming. I mean, it's probably going to come for all the candidates, but especially if your last name is Bush. So you really should not have been surprised by it, and I doubt he was surprised by it. But clearly, he wanted to stick to. I mean, that whether he misheard the question or just wanted to glide past the question, he clearly wanted to stick to a line of mistakes were made, but Obama screwed it up by unraveling the surge.
And
getting past the knowing what we know now premise. But this is probably the biggest black mark on the Bush presidency. And you know, this is sort of analogous to what happened in Britain with Ed Miliband, the surprise defeat in the British elections last week. Because if you're following the race, you could see, you know, Miliband was getting tagged with the failures of the last Labour government, which, you know, overlapped with the Bush administration. So they were getting hit with not so much the Iraq war, because that is sort of past for them, but the financial crash. And so Miliband kept getting hit with, you know, him saying, well, I'm going to fix the economy and I'm going to cut the deficit, and getting hit with, well, you guys didn't do that last time. You know, and Miliband was trying to separate himself from the mistakes of the past, but it was very nuanced, and he was literally a member of that government. So it's sort of like Walter Mondale in 1984. You know, you were literally part of the Carter government. You literally were around when the economy tanked. Why should I turn to you now to fix things? So if you're Jeb Bush and your brother was George Bush, you got to do something pretty dramatic. I mean, he wasn't part of the administration, but obviously he's a fealty there. You got to do something pretty dramatic to say, I'm not going to do that.
Well,
and I think this is true for all the Republican candidates.
I don't even
but
know.
You got to take that question. I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Bill, and maybe that's a smart move, but I don't even know that you have to do that. I think what you have to do, though, is have an answer, a coherent answer. And I think Chris Christie, here's what he had to say to Jake Tapper, and I think this is a pretty good answer. I think President Bush made the best decision he could at the time, given that his intelligence community was telling him that there were, and he means weapons of mass destruction, and that there were other threats right there in Iraq. But I don't think you can honestly say that if we knew then that there were no WMDs, that the country should have gone to war. I mean, you may not agree with that, but that is a rational and coherent response that doesn't throw President Bush, your brother, if you're Jeb, under the bus, but sort of acknowledges the realities and I think lets the public know that you get it, that you are not going to make the same mistakes. Look, let me just quickly kind of go through my thinking on this for what it's worth. I wrote something about this at The Week recently. Number one, I think it is fair, you may disagree, but I think it is fair to acknowledge that in a post 9/11 world, if you believe that Saddam has WMDs, I'm somewhat sympathetic with President Bush's plight based on the intelligence that was offered. Now, what can you learn from that? One, I think you can learn that that dictators who face an existential threat, you know, from within and externally, will lie, as Saddam did, or not be terribly transparent about what they do and do not have. Number two, I think it's important to know, to sort of be a little skeptical of what the so-called experts are telling you as president. I think that's something that you can learn from this, that the intelligence is often faulty, that the so-called experts are often wrong. People who make a career out of military, guess what? Like doing military things. If all you have is a hammer, you think every problem is a nail, whatever. So I think that's one lesson to learn. I think there's also the lesson, though, that I think everyone on the right, all the Republicans agree, that the surge worked, but it took Bush way too long. They tried to do this with too few soldiers, too few troops. I think a much bigger thing that ought to be learned is the perils of nation building, just in general. That, you know, it took, you know, Western civilization from the signing of the Magna Carta in 1215 till today, centuries to evolve institutions like the rule of law that could sustain democracy in our form of government. We had to fight a civil war in the process. You know, it didn't come easy for us, by the way, and it's a little bit unrealistic to expect that we can export democracy. It's quixotic, it's un-Burkean, it's unconservative. That's a big lesson, I think, that you could have learned. And then I think lastly, the lesson would be, obviously, I agree that it was a huge mistake to withdraw the residual forces, that Obama does bear, he is complicit to a certain degree, not in the foundational fundamental problems of this, but in sort of losing the peace. And so I think there are a lot of lessons to learn. And I think it's fair for us to expect that our next president has learned some of those lessons. And if they haven't, I think it's a serious problem.
Well, it's more than fair. I mean, I think it's a huge cloud over the Republican Party that voters are going to demand. We want to know how you're going to do foreign policy different than George Bush did, because that did not work. Show me that you've learned something.
Right.
I don't think they necessarily have to learn all of your specific lessons. I mean, there might be,
and this doesn't,
there are elements of the Republican Party that don't want to take the lessons that you took personally.
Yeah. And you don't have to become a dove to do this. You do not have to become, you know, a pacifist to do this. You do not even have to bash George W. Bush to do this. All the things that I am espousing here, I think are, you know, responsible and conservative. And I believe in peace through strength and a strong national, you know, foreign policy. And I don't even, I'm not even a realist in the sense that I actually do believe that there are cases when we should intervene based on humanitarian reasons. But I do think that the idea of nation building, of exporting democracy, and even just something as simple as trusting the intelligence community as gospel truth, I mean, are all things that need to be, taken to heart here.
Well, and what you're doing there is taking the question to lay out what your foreign policy goals are and your criteria for military intervention, which I think is what people are craving to hear from Republicans, especially because of how bad Iraq went. The Christie answer to me kind of clears the basic bar of common sense as far as I would not have gone to Iraq with there no evidence of WMD, knowing what we know now. It doesn't go that next step in laying out what your basic foreign policy vision is and your military intervention criteria is. But better than what Jeb did it. And that's right. And for Jeb in particular, it's such a missed opportunity because this is his chance to say, here's how I would do things differently than my brother. He keeps saying, I'm my own man. Well, you got to prove it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean throwing him under the bus completely, but you got to at least be able to say, look, you know, he made the best decision he could have with the intelligence that he had. Knowing what we know now, I would not have done that. And here's how I would have handled Saddam, or here's how I would handle other anti-democratic dictators going forward, learning the lessons of history. I think if he doesn't do that, look, he can probably get the nomination anyway, because I think his competition is still pretty weak, but I think he'll have a very, very tough time in the general election without having gone through that process.
I think Ted Cruz, interestingly, as I think I've probably said here before, arguably has the best foreign policy so far. It seems to be the guy who's kind of learned the lessons and is staking out a Reagan-esque middle ground on this. So stay tuned to that.
Now, you mentioned earlier that these Jeb questions came from friendly fire, from Megyn Kelly and Sean Hannity, two Fox News personalities. Should that unnerve the RNC, who have said, we're going to reclaim the debates, we're going to take them away from the evil liberal media, we're not going to let MSNBC get a debate anymore, no cheap shot contraception questions from George Stephanopoulos, they're going to be RNC sanctioned debates, they're only going to be 9 to 12, we're not going to have 20 And we're going to put on people like Hugh Hewitt alongside the CNN people to make sure that we get, you know, real good questioning that doesn't, that's not out to make us look bad. Well, look, you can still look bad. You can still look pretty bad. How do you get a question from a conservative journalist?
Yeah. Well, I think a couple things. I mean, think like number one, let's not only should you learn the lessons from Iraq, but like learn the lessons from these gaffes. I mean, don't go into debates with so-called friendly interviewers, assuming you're going to get softballs, and assuming that they're going to be friendly. I mean, it's fraught with danger. I think the truth is that at least half the time that Republican candidates mess up and blame the liberal media, it's not the liberal media's fault. You know, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's like a cheap shot question, or it's a wedge issue, or it's a gotcha question. But half the time, at least, it's just because the Republican should have had a better answer. And so it's a crutch to blame the liberal media, and it leads to problems when you get caught up in questions that are not being asked by the liberal media. You have to be able to answer questions effectively and eloquently and look, it's tough. I mean, everybody makes mistakes, but this is the big leagues. I mean, you're in Yankee Stadium, and you know, I don't know how well I would do, you know, answering questions about the United Nations or something. But I'm not running for president, and so you know, I think there's certain expectations, and I think what Republicans are hoping to do are get away from the sort of wedge issue questions. So, questions probably that have to do that are like intentionally trying to make Republicans look bad about something like, say, gay marriage. So maybe by having conservative, you know, debate moderators, you'll have less of those kind of questions. But it doesn't mean you won't still have tough questions, and it doesn't mean that Republicans won't still say Republican candidates won't still say something stupid.
Now, this other issue with the debates is coming up, that the New York Times wrote about it recently. How are they going to decide who gets to be on the stage? I mean, the first debates now, first debate is August.
Yeah.
So we're talking three months away from the first Republican debate. And there may be, you know, more than a dozen or close to 20 candidates by then. Who is the guy that says, hey, Carly Fiorina, you're the only woman candidate here, but you can't get more than 1% in Iowa, so you can't be on the stage. I mean, that's sort of what they're grappling with. They want to have a criteria that's seen as that's a fair criteria, but they don't want it to cut off whatever elements of diversity that they have in their field and make it be a bunch of old white guys all over again. That seems to be what they're struggling with. And I suppose they also don't want to seem like that they're just taking out the most pure conservative voices and feel like that's the establishment big footing the Tea Party all over again. How do they solve this? I mean, this is what you get when you want to control the debates. You then own all the decisions that go with those debates. Are they going to regret having these all be RNC sanctioned affairs?
So this has been an interesting topic of debate today. Jonathan Martin at the New York Times has a really good piece up. I saw somebody at the Washington Post has written about this conundrum as well. It's unclear what criteria will be used to decide who gets in the debates and who doesn't. Typically, early on, there's more latitude to allow more candidates in. And then at some point, you have to be polling at a certain threshold to be allowed in. This is a little bit of a catch-22. If you don't get in debates, you can't raise your poll numbers. But if you don't raise your poll numbers, you can't get into the debates. So really, in a way, this is almost the power to exclude is the power to destroy. I mean, if Mike Huckabee hadn't gotten in some of those early debates in 2008, he wouldn't have caught fire and ultimately given Romney a little or McCain a little bit of a run for their money, and ultimately propelled his career. So it's really fascinating. You gave your disclaimer earlier. I should probably give mine again. You know, my wife advises Rick Pack. And so I mean, there's an example of somebody. What if he doesn't get in? It would be ridiculous. This is the longest serving governor of Texas. What about John Kasich, right? I think he's probably going to run. I think he had like 64% of the vote or something like that in Ohio. What about Bobby Jindal? What if Ben Carson, who's never been elected to anything, and Carly Fiorina, who's never been elected to anything, what if they get in the debates? Because obviously they're fresh, exciting, and more diverse in terms of having the optics of a Republican debate, you know, that's more diverse in terms of gender and ethnicity. What if they get in, but Kasich doesn't? Or even someone like Bobby Jindal, who was a, you know, Indian American governor, congressman, Rhodes Scholar, incredible resume, incredible background. What if he isn't polling good enough to get in the debates, but these other folks who've never been elected anything are? I mean, it's a huge conundrum. But on the other hand, how can you have 20 some people in a debate? It'd be ridiculous. It's unwieldy. You end up having
these you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they have to come to. I mean, you can't prematurely whittle down your field. You got to give everybody a shot, at least in the first one. Everyone's got to get one dance in the spotlight so they can say, I really had my chance to speak to the public. But I mean, 18 people on a stage is not a debate. It just isn't. That's a roundtable discussion at best. So. I think you have to break that up. You have to sort of have little groups of five. Do five for a half hour, another five for the next half hour, another five for the next half hour, just so everybody has their chance to bat a few questions around. You're not going to have a true back and forth with 18, 19 people on a stage. It's physically impossible. And if the first debate is not a traditional debate, then that's okay. You're going to have other ones when the field does get narrowed down. But I just don't see how else you approach that problem without breaking it up into smaller chunks.
And that's what Bobby Jindal's people are suggesting, having two or three debates with like five or six candidates, I guess, in each one, and sort of randomly selecting them. Ultimately, this could become like a tournament, you know, like a bracket system where like the person who wins the first debate squares off against the person who wins the second debate to see who goes on to the next debate. I mean, in our entertainment world, that would be like the obvious, like, you know, maybe it'll take us a couple of election cycles to get to the kind of the running man version of of presidential elections where like people are voting, you know, texting the number to see if Ted Cruz should face off against, you know, Carly Fiorina or something in tomorrow night's debate.
You know, well, they had, I mean, they didn't have it, you know, quite tournament style in Britain. You know, they don't have the same tradition of head-to-head debates in Britain that we have because they're parliamentary elections and not presidential elections. But they're sort of moving in that direction. David Cameron was really resistant to have face-to-face debates. And what they instead had was they had one thing where each Cameron and Miliband were interviewed individually by a sort of Bill O'Reilly style reporter who was really, you know, brutal to both of them equivalently. And then they were let loose on a town hall and British town halls are also brutal settings. Then they had a 7-person debate that Cameron didn't do, but Miliband did with the other smaller parties. And that was more like a traditional debate. And then they had one that was just strictly town hall with Cameron and Miliband and the third party Liberal Democrats all getting a turn on the stage, but that was all town hall with a moderator. No, they weren't head to head. So there's different ways you could mix it up. It doesn't all have to be a bunch of people on a podium with a moderator, just to handle the fact that you have so many people you got to sift through and give them all a chance. I just don't see any other way that you do it. If your only choice everybody on the stage at the same time, it's not going to be a real debate. You're not going to get what you want.
Yeah. I don't know what they're going to do. I really don't know what they're going to do. And I think it is within the realm of possibility that they do some where they break this thing up into a couple debates in different, you know, the same night or something with different people randomly debating. You have some precedent there across the pond, but I don't I can't think of this ever happening here. But I just think part of the problem with the whole clown car that you had last time, you've addressed the problem of the moderators. You've addressed the problem of too many debates. But what do you do about too many candidates? That's a part of the equation.
Was it some issue we were going to talk about today, or did we cover our bases?
There are multiple topics, Bill, that we could always go into, but I think we're good. I think we've hit all the big stuff. I do want to plug real quick. I had a Wall Street Journal column called "The Conservative PACs Trolling for Your Money." Draft Alan West, get Condi into the game. They're not on board with these efforts, but fundraisers don't care. So you can find that at the Wall Street Journal. Check that out, everyone. I appreciate it. Listen to my podcast.
And that was a pretty big spread, too. You weren't like tucked in the corner next to like the weird poetry. You know, you had like a big, you know, above the fold in the op-ed page spread there.
I am tempted to hold it up to the camera. I have it here close by. I don't know if it would translate well, but it is something, Bill. Even in this day and age when we consume almost everything, you know, electronically, digitally, it's pretty cool when you've got almost a full page story with like the picture and everything, something you wrote. It's still pretty. It feels good. I got to be honest. It's a nice thing.
Anyway, and you're kicking up some dust going. I mean, I mean, I'm on a bunch of email lists now. I mean, I get a lot of very dubious conservative email pitches from Fly By Night operations, and they feel very analogous to, you know, being scammed for reverse mortgages. You know, in your email feed. And you probably always wonder, like, who actually clicks the link to give money to the Nigerian businessman? I mean, who really does that?
Yeah.
But people actually get conned by these, you know, give here to help Alan West become emperor of the world pitches.
Well, you know, I interviewed some of the people, and they have an argument. Believe it or not, I mean, there is an argument that, that grassroots PACs need to start building lists and raising money, and that candidate recruitment is an important and valid role. And maybe you can talk Alan West into moving. He'd have to move from Texas, by the way, moving back to Florida to run. I tried to be, you know, fair in this piece. I think I'm pretty proud of it. Please go read it. Check it out. The Conservative PACs Trolling for Your Money. I think it presents sort of both sides to this debate. But it is interesting, and it's something that it's sort of the new, and there have always been things like this, but it's the new, it's kind of the new wave, the brave new world of fundraising and, you know, and supporting candidates and whatnot. Also, Bill, I've got my little podcast going, and really interesting interviews. I suppose I interviewed Kirsten Powers about her new book, and Jonathan V. Last has a book. I think it's called The Daddy Virtues, where a bunch of different people, including my boss Tucker Carlson, have written chapters on fatherhood. I'm going to have Jonathan V. Last on the podcast, and I just interviewed Stu Stevens, who is was Romney's top advisor. But this guy's unbelievable. He's a travel writer. He like traveled across Africa with a ex-fashion model and wrote a travel book about it. He actually wrote some of the, I think he wrote like the first episode of the TV show Northern Exposure. He went on steroids and wrote an article about steroid use. He sort of did it for artistic reasons. Just a fascinating cat, and just interviewed him on the podcast. Why don't you plug some stuff, Bill? What do you got in the hopper now?
I got nothing to plug today.
You got nothing.
I got Bupkis, but so go check out Matt. Go check out his Wall Street Journal piece. Go check out his podcast. I'll come up with something between now and next week, and I'll plug it next week.
Well, I like that. That's a good plug. Read my stuff. and listen to us. You know, you can find us on Twitter, DMZ Show, Facebook. You can download this as an audio podcast as well. I guess that's it. I think we're just rocking and rolling here, man. Just, you know, putting out consistently good,
all right,
good shows. Thank you, Bill, for indulging me and promoting all my stuff this week.
Always a pleasure.
All right, buddy.
I'll see you next week.
Catch you next week in the DMZ. Thanks.